Good afternoon, this is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I am recording this on Wednesday and it will be played tomorrow on Thursday. So welcome to the show. I tried to fix my space binoculars. I have a big set of binoculars and a little set of binoculars. And I'm trying to somehow fix it because I dropped it on the ground and it broke. So I wanted to look at the sky, and there is quite clear skies at anyway today. Last week I talked about a full moon, I think it was called a blood moon. And this week was a real bonus for me because I changed cable providers, and now I have NASA TV that came with it. And there are so many good shows. Of course, I would say good show because I'm an astronomer and it's all about astronomy. But the best part of it was there was lots on things that have been appearing in the news more lately, at least on space.com or Life Science or NASA.gov, about research in microgravity. And this is being done on the space station. And there's a new space station coming online quite soon, I believe. And I just, at this moment, I don't remember the name of it. But of course, they're talking also about the low Earth economy. And I was very happy to hear there's no delay on the Artemis or the Gateway program for the moon. And they are still aiming for 2024, which is 2 years from now, for a woman and a person of color to walk on the moon. So that is good that that is going ahead, because as we know, with our Webb Space Telescope, a lot of people were waiting for it. And on NASA TV, there was one show about the space telescope, and part of it was explaining why it was delayed for so long. So it was originally scheduled to come online in 2007. And it wasn't launched till December 2021. So that's about a 14 or 13 and a half year delay. So that was a long delay. And part of the reason, it's simple, why there was such a big delay. There was optimistic projections, at least that's what they said on the show. And when it came down to, here's an example, the mirrors will have to fit together, the mirror segments. And on Earth, of course, we have room temperatures about 20, 25 degrees Celsius. When the Webb Space Telescope, right now anyways, when it is in its position at the Lagrangian point 2, it is operating in a very cold environment. And there's of course the, I think it's a 5-layer or 7-layer paper thin, or even thinner than paper, sun shield that is protecting the telescope from the heat of the sun. So it's something like 50 degrees above absolute zero or something like that. It could be 10 degrees above absolute zero, I'm not sure. But it had to be very cold. And the material science part of it is very important, because when the temperature changes like that from room temperature to the operating temperature of the mirrors can warp or change shape. So they had to engineer in all these things about, okay, when it is in outer space, things will change. And they had to, when they came to engineering those things, apparently it took longer than they thought it would, but it was very complicated. And of course, it's the most technologically advanced space telescope ever. So this was on NASA TV, and they have shown some images from the Webb Space Telescope. And there is one article here, I will get to it later. It said something like this, along this line. Okay, we have these pictures from Webb. What's the big deal? For most people, it'll just look like a bunch of galaxies out there, or stars, or whatever it is. We won't be impressed by it in the same way that scientists will be impressed by it. So hopefully I can get to that article. But anyway, Webb is out there, and it is doing its job now. And it's apparently, it sustained a little micrometeor strike in one, I think it could be one of its mirrors, but it's still operating. And there's lots of things that are threatening for the Webb telescope, or that were threatening for the Webb telescope. So what I mean by that, in this documentary about the Webb Space Telescope, on typical launches, the narrator said there are 5 to 10 fail points. So that means there's 5 to 10 things that could go wrong, and if these things do go wrong, it will doom the project. So on, let's say, when astronauts go up in space to the space station, it's, of course, there's people on board and everybody cares about safety. So apparently there's 5 or 10 things during the launch process that could go wrong. And again, I said earlier, just a couple seconds ago, these 5 or 10 things could doom the project. Well, on Webb, there wasn't 5 or 10 things. There was, I believe, 344 things. So from launch to it getting to its point in space, and then getting the Webb telescope, I think it was 6 or 7 months to get it to unfold and prepare all its equipment and stuff. So they said there was 344 fail points, which is a lot more than 5 or 10 for a typical launch. So the Webb Space Telescope was very complicated, and it is complicated, and I suppose a lot of people would, during the process of getting Webb up there and getting it to work, probably held their breath a lot. But that was 6 months holding your breath, so I don't think they held their breath, but they were definitely nervous about this. Just like when these people at JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or whoever's working on a project, they would hold their breath for 7 minutes, because as soon as a spacecraft that's launched towards Mars hits the Martian atmosphere, the very wispy Martian atmosphere, it is 7 minutes of terror. And the Mars is quite far away at that time from the Earth, so there's no way to have direct communication. So I believe it's just programmed in for the rover, or whatever it is, to go through its touchdown and the 7 minutes of terror. And then later, when they finally do receive a signal from it, they clap, they go crazy, because, as I said, it's 7 minutes of terror. They don't know if it's going to land. Someone's racing their car outside. It sounds like one of these cars, these speedy cars. But anyway, so this is what happened with Webb. There were so many things that could go wrong. And when they, again, as I said, when they get to points, when they get to the problems they have to solve in order to get this done, it took a lot longer than they thought it would. So one example, as I just said, is when the mirrors get up into space and into the Lagrange 2 point and the sun shields go up, then it's going to be very cold there. So as I said, the material in the mirrors are going to change shape or warp due to this cold temperature. Just like when Napoleon's soldiers went and marched into Russia, the change in temperature, their buttons fell off because the properties of the stuff that their buttons were made of, they changed properties, and the buttons just fell off. So all of a sudden the people froze to death. And Sir John Franklin, when apparently he went on his first voyage through the Northwest Passage, or it could have been a second voyage, but the ship was lost because apparently what happened is the cans broke apart, because in the cold weather they changed their properties, and the cans holding a lot of the things, and that's could be one of the reasons that the mission failed. So material science is very important for these missions, and that's one of the things they're doing research on in the International Space Station. So these things all had to be solved, and that's why it took 14 more years than they had planned to get Webb up into the sky operating. And it was very complicated, much more complicated than they thought it would be. So now they are doing research on the space station, and as I said, I've watched quite a few programs on NASA TV, and one of the problems I had with watching the programs is I watched one after another after another after another, and some of them were about research in microgravity. Some of them were about the moon launches and the problems they face and the things they had to overcome, and just Webb telescope, a lot of different topics. So I watched it one morning till 6 in the morning, and it was so fascinating, and I wanted to talk about some of those topics, but I didn't think I would watch that many hours for that many days, and now my mind is all muddled and cluttered with all the information I try to take in. But one of the things that I did remember was the research in microgravity about flames. So when the typical flame burns on Earth, the fire burns on Earth, this program said the flame is anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 degrees. And I'm not sure if that's Celsius or Fahrenheit, because this is an American show. But anyway, let's just say it's Celsius for now. When the flame burns in microgravity, it has a different shape. So there's a dome. It's not like a big flame flickers up. And there's a dome, and the flame is under that dome, so it looks like a semicircle. And the flame burns at about 500 to 1,000 degrees. So even though that's very hot for us, that's much cooler than a flame would burn on Earth. So one of the practical aspects, and there has to be practical aspects to all this, is that a combustion engine here on Earth would burn at that 2,000 to 4,000 degrees. And if they can somehow, with the research in microgravity, and get it to work in an engine like that, it could burn at 5 to 1,000 degrees. So it could be much more efficient burn, so you use less fuel. So that's one of the applications they're looking at for this. There was also fluid research, and there was gels. So they were seeing how things behave in microgravity. And one of the things that I do remember is that they were planting seeds in microgravity. And I think what happens is the gravity here on Earth, it works to pull the root down. And so the seed grows in gravity. And what happens when you're in microgravity and there's no microgravity, or there's no gravity to signal to the root which way to go down? So there's so many things that are different in microgravity. And I think what happened is they are doing, at this point, 300 research projects on the space station. And they don't just do a research project to prove something and then move on from it. They do these to have practical application spin-offs on Earth. So there is so much going on in the International Space Station in terms of microgravity research and other kinds of research. And the low Earth economy, as I said before, there is an untold amount of research going on up there that it's not on the news. So if we watch the news, we will hear, okay, Webb reached its point, or Webb is now operational, or this rover worked, or this helicopter worked on Mars. So there's the big headlines we hear about, and there's so much other stuff that we do not hear about. And one of the ladies, she's a PhD in chemistry. She's an astronaut. She's been on the space station, so she's been in space. She had a show, and her co-host was a male that was also, I think, a PhD in chemical engineering. And they were describing some of the chemistry experience on the space station. And I have a particular interest in chemistry. And years ago when I learned about how the such interesting chemistry when the Cassini spacecraft was up in the Saturn system, it's just so fascinating how this chemistry plays out. And not just that, some of these things are expected. So when certain things happen, then the scientists are expecting it to happen. But what is probably more interesting is a lot of the things that all of a sudden happened that they didn't suspect would happen, and they learn new things. some total surprises. So that's some of the things that happened with these research project. And when, for example, Cassini went into the Saturn system, there's so much that is learned that, okay, we expected this to happen, or we did this experiment to find the answer to a certain thing. But then there's the surprises, which are the great things, the great mysteries, and all of a sudden there's so much that's learned about this. So again, I've said this last week, I'm so excited about the future of space exploration and what NASA's doing. And of course, NASA brings in Canada as a partner on many of these missions. And sometimes I have disappointment in what Canada does or doesn't do. And I'm not saying bad things about the scientists. For example, Dr. Matthews at UBC, he, I think it was called the MOST space telescope, or he called it the LEAST. But there was a telescope that Canada had, and I think it was a Planet Hunter, among other things. And other countries were leasing or renting or paying for time on the telescope. So the telescope was basically paying for itself, for most of itself. But then the Canadian government canceled it. And there was other things that were canceled as well, like the Kaon factory that George Bush was big on it, and he wanted to, I think it's George Bush Sr., he wanted to contribute a lot, and other countries were going to contribute a lot. So it was going to be the Kaon factory for UBC, a very high-tech thing, and then Kretschmann cancels it, and instead he said, well, we're going to give you a more practical thing. We're going to build you a new sewer. Okay. So there's so many things that when I read these articles and I watch NASA TV, how many space places, like they built one in Alabama for rockets, and how much high tech is developed in the States. So now there is so much scientific research going there, and you know, Canada does so much great science, but then if you could say the US has 10 times the population that Canada has, that's true. Okay, so we have 1/10 of the population. So do we have 1/10 of the research that the US has? Probably much lower than that, because the US invests a lot more in science and technology and engineering, and our scientists want to do the best they can. They're great scientists, and some of them have won Nobel Prizes. But as I said, the MOST Space Telescope, if that would have been kept alive, that's something Canada's doing, and we could advance our technology, and the government canceled it. So that's what I'm talking about. It's not the disappointment in the scientists, because I know they're great scientists, like Professor Unruh and Matthews and so many good, and I'm trying to remember that person, Dr. Stairs, that does research on I believe it's neutron stars. So there is lots of going on, and the US, as I said, it invited us into this Webb Space Telescope and a lot of other projects, the Canada arm and the other arms and on the space shuttle and the International Space Station. That's great. That was done by Canada. But the Canadian government, when it cancels things like the MOST Space Telescope, and it's probably a fraction of the cost of anything that the US does, and they cancel these all. So that's what I was talking about when I was mentioning my disappointment, not in the scientists, but in how our research is not funded in the same way, to the same level as the US. Even when we have opportunities to carry on modest projects, the government cancels it. So I guess the US also spends a lot of money on military, much more than Canada does. Okay, so I'm going to talk today about, I wanted to talk about the research on the International Space Station, but I told myself I'll wait a week because I watch so many NASA shows and my mind is clouded now. But the type of research that they do, like for example, when they take that flame and they showed the flame, it's like a dome, and in microgravity, the flame burns much cooler, and there's going to probably be a lot of spin-offs from that. and fluid research and materials research and gels and how they behave in space. And one of the favorite ones I talked about a few months ago was how they're building space telescopes in space, in microgravity, out of water, out of liquid, and the physics does the job of getting the mirror to be flat. You don't have to polish it, you don't have to grind it, so it costs a lot less money and a lot less work. And the U.S. is leading in that kind of stuff. And but for me, myself, I'm very excited about this Gateway project, the Artemis rockets, when hopefully, as they're saying, in 2 years we'll have people stepping on the moon again. And they're all saying it's a prelude to rehearsing for Mars. But there's lots to overcome with in terms of getting to Mars. I did read last night, on Tuesday night, about private companies wanting to get to Mars. And I think Elon Musk was saying he wanted to get to Mars too. So they might just do it. So I will take a break now. But when I come back, there's lots of topics to talk about. And as I said, I was so excited about the work in microgravity, how these experiments are carried out, and I can't wait to learn more about those. But again, I overdid it. I watched so many NASA shows for so many hours in a row, for so many days in a row, that my mind was cluttered with so much information, and my mind can't handle that much information. So I'll come back, and what I'm going to talk about is a solar storm. And we'll learn more about this solar storm. It's called a canyon of fire. Wow. And these things are dangerous. So again, there's NASA's doing work on all this. So hopefully we can mitigate any ill effects of a solar storm that might hit Earth. And there's the Parker Solar Probe out there. As I mentioned before, it's finding out so much more. I thought it was so much known about the sun, but there's so much that is not known about the sun. I'll come back in a few minutes. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. And there was talk on a TV show. It was just, I think it was called the Stephen Colbert Show. And they started talking about NASA and all the work it's doing. And there was talk about hotels in space that are coming soon, so people can take a honeymoon in outer space. Wouldn't that be cool? So I think our lives might be within the next 5 years. So what's the date today? July 20th. So we'll see 2022. We'll see in 5 years from now, July 27th, 2027. We'll see how far things have advanced. And of course, I interviewed the person that is working on WFIRST, the successor to the James Webb Space Telescope. So I should get myself in motion and look more into what's happening with that. So I did interview him, and I felt like he didn't really want to talk to me. But what happens is, what's great about one of the NASA web pages, all of them, they are at the bottom of the page. There's a media person you can contact, and they get you in touch with the scientists. So they get you an interview with these people. And what happens, though, is it seems these people aren't too interested in wasting their time with Marco from Astro Talk. So I did remember I had to wait 6 months because this person kept saying he's busy, and he finally relented to the interview, and I appreciate it, but he wasn't, I thought, the kindest that he could be to me. I guess I was just a pest that wouldn't go away. So now I'm going to read about this Canyon of Fire solar storm that will slam into the earth today or tomorrow. So this is published on LifeScience.com by Ben Turner. It is published today, July 20th. So I'm going to read this. Again, it's called Canyon of Fire solar storm will slam into earth today or tomorrow. And I got to make a little comment here that the red dwarf stars or smaller stars, they're much more temperamental than Earth. So if we did want to go to another exoplanet and colonize it and live there, if we go to, I think 70% of the stars in our solar system or the universe are these little red dwarfs, but they're very, they can spout solar flares hundreds of times a day even. So at least once a day. So we have to keep that in consideration. And these astronomers or engineers are talking like, yeah, we can do it, we can get it done. Well, let's see first, this gotta get to Mars first. But anyway, here is a picture. It says the solar filaments bursting over the sun's northern hemisphere, image credit from NASA Solar Dynamics Observatory, SDO. Solar winds from the snapping of a gigantic canyon of fire filament on the sun are set to slam into Earth today, July 20th, or tomorrow, July 21st, triggering a weak G1 geomagnetic storm. Sun watchers first spotted solar filaments as dark, thread-like lines against the sun's bright background on July 12th, according to spaceweather.com. Then on July 15th, a filament that had smacked its way down our star's northern hemisphere erupted, carving out a roughly 238,800-mile or 384,400-kilometer long and 12,400-mile or 20,000-kilometer deep canyon of fire on the sun's surface and belching solar material right at us. Solar filaments are huge, so huge arcs of electrified glass for plasma, worming their way through the sun's atmosphere according to the whims of the star's powerful magnetic field. These giant magnetic tubes can hold huge masses of plasma above the sun's surface, but they're also very unstable, and once they collapse, they launch explosive jets of solar wind called coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, barreling towards the Earth. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to kick myself in the head, because I've told you guys before, I'm going to look at this website, spaceweather.com. And guess what? I have not looked at it. So I'm going to write down now, spaceweather.com. That way, I can force myself to look at this website because it does seem interesting. Every day, I watch the weather on Earth and the weather in BC and things like that. So I am interested in weather. So why not look at this website? And I did remember in my undergraduate, I took a physics of weather course. So that was kind of interesting. You take a parcel of air and you examine it. Cool, huh? Okay, related. Ancient solar storm smashed Earth at the wrong part of the sun cycle and scientists are concerned. Okay, I'll look at that later. So says Tamitha Skov, a space weather physicist who wrote on Twitter following the eruption, and quote, the long snake-like filament cartwheel its way off the sun in a stunning ballet. The magnetic orientation of this Earth-directed solar storm is going to be tough to predict. G2 level, possibly G3 conditions may occur if the magnetic field in the storm is oriented southward. So again, there's a different way to categorize these. I think there's up to G4, there could be up to G5. But anyway, so this solar storm is now apparently headed towards us. And if there was going to be any danger to Vancouver, maybe our weather would tell us about it, or maybe it wouldn't. But NASA is the one that usually tells us about these things. So there is a solar storm heading our way. And guess what? We are going to be apparently There's no way to avoid it. We are going to be hit by it. G2 and G3 storms are ones that are considered moderate and strong, respectively. The CME ejected by the filaments collapse should slam into Earth today or tomorrow. On planets that have strong magnetic fields like our own, our magnetic field absorbs the barrage of solar debris from CMEs, triggering powerful geomagnetic storms. During these storms, Earth magnetic fields gets compressed slightly by the waves of highly energetic particles, which trickle down magnetic field lines near the poles and agitate molecules in the atmosphere, releasing energy in the form of light to create colorful auroras similar to the ones that make up the northern lights. Okay, now why not play this? This is a video that says, "Can geomagnetic storms affect our planet?" Hi, I just tried to play the video about the solar storm explanation and it can't play. So I'm just going to keep reading the article. Thankfully, the storm coming from this filament is a weak one. Classified as a G1 storm, it has the potential to cause fluctuation in power grids and impact some satellite functions, including those for mobile devices and GPS systems, but not dramatically. It will also bring the aurora as far south as Michigan and Maine. So maybe we can see the aurora in Vancouver tonight or tomorrow night. More extreme geomagnetic storms can disrupt our planet's magnetic field powerfully enough to send satellites tumbling to Earth. Life Science previously reported, and scientists have warned, that extreme geomagnetic storms could even cripple the internet. Erupting debris from CMEs usually takes around 15 to 18 hours to reach Earth, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Space Weather Prediction Center. But it can, like this CME, move slow and take longer to arrive. This storm comes as the sun climbs into its most active phase of the roughly 11-year long solar cycle. It is the second solar storm to have hit Earth in 24 hours. Astronomers have known since 1775 that solar activity rises and falls in cycles, but recently the sun has been more active than expected, with nearly double the sunspot appearance predicted by NOAA. The sun's activity is projected to steadily climb for the next few years, reaching an overall maximum in 2025 before decreasing again. A paper published July 20 in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics proposed a new model for the sun's activity by separately counting sunspots in each hemisphere, a method the paper's researchers argue could be used to make more accurate solar forecasts. Scientists think the largest solar storm ever witnessed during contemporary history was the 1859 Carentan event, which released roughly the same energy as 10 billion 1 megaton atomic bombs. After slamming into Earth, the powerful stream of solar particles fried telegraph systems all over the world and cause auroras brighter than the light of the full moon to appear as far south as the Caribbean. If a similar event were to happen today, scientists warn, it would cause trillions of dollars of damage and trigger widespread blackouts, much like the 1989 solar storm that released a billion-ton plume of plasma and caused a blackout across the entire Canadian province of Quebec, NASA reported. So I believe that was during winter, so that was no fun for them in Quebec, was it? Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to try to play this video again. Let's see if I can. It hasn't let me twice, but why not try to be optimistic and see if it will let me play the video for the third time. And here we are. I'll tell you in a couple seconds if it starts.
So they can cause damage. So one of the most recent kind of power outages that was caused by a storm of this type was the 1989 Quebec power cut, which was caused by a geomagnetic storm. Now, most of the time, especially when it comes to people who provide like power lines and stuff, a lot of them have shielded like their like power cables and things like that with a kind of Faraday cage, basically, which diverts the energy. Or they also have like other techniques that allow them to kind of siphon off excess energy that might be given to power lines by storms like this.
Okay.
But, like, that hasn't always been the case. Like, especially back in 1859, there was a really big event called the Great Carrington Event, which was the largest sort of solar storm in modern human history. I'm sure there have been solar storms just as large throughout our past, but, like, before that point, we weren't really documenting it, and we didn't have many electronics around, so we didn't really care. But in this case, the Great Carrington Event fried most of the telegram systems in the US and in Europe that had been developed at the time.
Really?
And it also led to auroras that could be seen around, like, as far south as the Caribbean. And, like, there were people waking up at night thinking that it was daytime in the Caribbean because of these enormous auroras from this event.
I mean, we're freaked out about it now when we see things like that. We know more, but I can't even imagine, you know, over 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of more modern sort of phenomena that have caused more modern damage, other than the Quebec event, recently, actually, there was another geomagnetic storm that caused the downing of 40 of SpaceX's Starlink satellites.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that happened. And on top of that as well, there's a potential risk that internet, like the internet in general, especially in the United States, could be cut out by a geomagnetic storm, because a lot of these cables run underwater through like latitudes that would be affected by it, and like you would have a geomagnetic storm. They're not shielded, so they would basically be probably quite severely affected by this. But as is the case with a lot of things and how they're done with legislation, it's like earthquakes. It doesn't often get legislated for until the worst has already happened.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, I really like the internet. I like to keep it around. This is how we get to communicate, right?
Exactly. Being across
the pond. But you're saying that we have protections now.
So I think most like power companies have already built in protections into their grids for these kind of things.
Okay.
It's just, yeah, you're not going to be getting any like, I guess, coronal mass ejection memes in the middle of a coronal mass ejection. You have to wait a few weeks for them to fix the power, the underwater cables.
Yeah, and luckily Earth, you know, we have this nice electromagnetic shield, right, already built in, otherwise we'd be, you know, goners, you know.
Yeah, it would fry us, and it would also fry our atmosphere. Like, a big reason why Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, for instance, is it doesn't really have a very active magnetic field. So all of the atmosphere, when it gets hit by these wave of like hydrogen, like particles, like protons, like the atmosphere gets stripped away quite quickly.
Poor Mars.
Yeah.
But that's why we're here, right? We're not. I mean, we are on Mars, but you know, not yet. Well, so is there a way to know when things like this will happen? I know we watch the sun. We have video of the sun. It seems more like after the fact.
Yeah, so you get a bit of advanced warning. Like, for instance, the Great Carrington Event is named after Richard Carrington, who spotted, like, intense solar flares in the sky, like a few hours, like maybe about 15 hours before the actual, like, event hit.
Uh-huh.
But the sun is quite a complex object. Like, there's loads going on in those magnetic fields. It's still really, really hard for scientists to predict what's going on there.
Yeah, if only. Well, until the next major astronomical event. Thanks.
Listen to that. I can't imagine if a solar storm would hit, let's say in Vancouver, knocked out the power, let's say in November, December, January, when we think it's cold, and I've been told it's very cold in Montreal and Winnipeg and places like that. And one of the reasons somebody explained to me the other day is Montreal is on a lake, or surrounded by water, so it's more water in the atmosphere, and then it just feels colder. So I can imagine there how cold people must have felt. And if I was here in Vancouver and there was no heat, ooh, I wouldn't like that. I do remember I was in southern China, living across the border from Hong Kong, and we didn't have any heat because it's South China. And South and Northern China for a long time did not have air conditioning. So when I was there, there was no heat, and I had to buy my own heater. But it felt cold, and it wasn't really that cold. It's just that we didn't have the heaters, and I think it got down a few times to 15 degrees or 10 degrees, and that felt really cold without a heater. So I can't imagine how in Vancouver we would feel about that. Okay, so I did get the video to play, which is very nice, and sometimes it's all about my computer, which is doesn't have a lot of memory, so sometimes I can't open pages, I can't do things that I want to with my computer. So here's a related article. Ancient solar storms smash Earth at the wrong part of the sun cycle, and scientists are concerned. So let's see if I can open this. Again, my computer is being stubborn, so let's see what I can do. So here's the article. Ancient solar storm smashed Earth at the wrong part of the sun cycle, and scientists are concerned. By Brandon Spector, published January 28, 2022, and the subtitle is The 9,200-year-old storm left researchers with a stark conclusion. We are not ready for the next one. So again, this is articles called Ancient Solar Storm Smash Earth at the Wrong Part of the Sun Cycle, and Scientists Are Concerned. So here is an artist depicting a massive solar flare or coronal mass ejection erupts out of the sun in 2017. Actually, it's a real picture. Wow. It looks so good. It looks like an illustration. An extremely powerful solar storm pummeled our planet 9,200 years ago, leaving permanent scars on the ice buried deep below Greenland and Antarctica. A new study of those ancient ice samples has found that this previously unknown storm is one of the strongest outbursts of solar weather ever detected, and what would have crippled modern communication systems if it had hit Earth today. But perhaps more surprising, the massive storm appears to have hit during a solar minimum, the point during the sun's 11-year cycle, when solar outbursts are typically much less common, according to the study, published January 11th in the journal Nature Communications. Because of this unexpected discovery, the study researchers are concerned that devastating solar storms could hit when we least expect them, and that Earth might not be prepared when the next big one arrives. So we talk about big ones, we talk about earthquakes, solar storms, or meteors or asteroids or whatever that hits us, and it looks like maybe it will hit one day, when maybe soon, and we are not prepared. A study co-author Raymond Muscheller, a geology researcher at the Lund University in Sweden, said, and quote, "These enormous storms are currently not sufficiently included in risk assessments. It is one of the utmost importance to analyze what these events could mean for today's technology and how we can protect ourselves and when stars attack." So here's a subsection called When Stars Attack. Solar storms occur when magnetic field lines on the sun's corona, the outermost part of the sun's atmosphere, become tangled up and then violently snap back into place. This sudden magnetic reconnection can release huge gouts of plasma and magnetic field known as coronal mass ejections, CMEs, which surf across space on the sun's ever-gusting solar wind. If a powerful CME passes over Earth, it can compress the planet's magnetic shield, causing what's known as a geomagnetic storm. Mild geomagnetic storms can damage satellites and internet radio transmissions. Severe storms, like the Halloween storms of 2003, can cause widespread power outages across the world and permanently damage electrical infrastructure such as power transformers. Some researchers fear that a sufficiently large solar storm could also ravage the world's undersea internet cables, resulting in an internet apocalypse that leaves huge chunks of the world population disconnected for months. So that's what the guy said on the video a bit earlier. CME outbursts typically peak every 11 years or so, when the sun enters the part of the natural activity cycle known as the solar maximum, the time when magnetic activity in the corona is in high gear. Today, satellites can monitor solar outbursts directly, but finding evidence of ancient storms requires some atomic detective work. The authors of the new study look for evidence of special particles known as cosmogenic radionuclides, never heard of that term before, essentially radioactive isotopes, versions of elements created when charged solar particles collide with elements in Earth's atmosphere. These radioactive particles can appear in natural records, like a tree ring or ice cones. And in the study, the authors looked at the latter, analyzing several cores drilled in Antarctica and Greenland. So I said earlier cones, it's cores. Cores from both locations showed a remarkable spike in the radionuclides beryllium-10 and chlorine-36 around 9,200 years ago, indicating that a powerful solar storm swept across Europe at the time. And I think they said it was a solar minimum. Further analysis of the cores showed that the storm was particularly powerful, perhaps on par with the most powerful solar storm ever detected, which occurred during a solar maximum between the years 775 BC and 774 BC. The newly discovered storm's occurrences during a solar minimum, when magnetic activity on the sun should be low, left the study authors puzzled and alarmed. This storm further pushes the magnitude of a potential worst-case scenario for solar storm events. According to the study authors, it is now essential for researchers to detect more ancient extreme storms in the ice core and tree ring records to determine if there is some sort of pattern beyond the sun's 11-year cycle that dictates when the most extreme storms will occur. Okay, there's another video here, and I'm not going to play it because it's just too much time. I will go for a break now. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com. Everybody who should live it, live it, live it. Go and get it, you should
live it, live it, live it. Welcome back. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I was talking with my cousin the other day, and I think he is, in terms of the people I've met, he's the most intelligent person I have ever met. So he's a retired veterinarian, and he was talking to me about epidemiology and diseases. How fascinating this stuff is, because we are at risk of, from things like COVID and other diseases, and he was explaining to me a lot of things about diseases, and it was cool. Okay, so let's look at a moon rocket. So there's a mega moon rocket that could head into space as soon as August 29th. So here it is, NASA's gargantuan mega moon rocket could head to space as soon as August 29. Okay, this is on livescience.com, published 5 hours ago, so it's published today, June 20th. This rocket will ultimately carry the first woman and person of color to the moon. NASA's Artemis mission, which will ultimately return humans to the moon's surface for the first time in 50 years, including the first woman and person of color to set foot there, could launch as soon as late August, agency officials said in a news briefing on Wednesday, July 20th. The first phase of the mission, dubbed Artemis 1, will see NASA's massive new space launch system, SLS, launch on a 4 to 6 week long trip around the far side of the moon and back. NASA has eyed August 29, September 2nd, or September 5th as the earliest possible launch dates for the mission. NASA Associate Administrator Jim Free told reporters. Such an exciting thing. The precise date of the mission will be announced about a week in advance, NASA added. The Artemis 1 mission will be totally uncrewed, with an empty Orion crew capsule riding atop the top of the SLL. According to Artemis mission manager Mike Serafin, the main objective of the mission is to test the effectiveness of Orion's heat shield, which will be subjected to temperatures about half as hot as the sun as the capsule plunges through Earth's atmosphere during the reentry phase of the mission. NASA plans to recover the capsule after it splashes down into the ocean, then thoroughly study its wear and tear before allowing astronauts to ride aboard it on future launches. Artemis 2 will be the mission's first crewed flight, flying astronauts around the moon but not landing there. Artemis 3 will see astronauts touch down at the lunar South Pole with the goal of establishing a permanent base there. The success of the mission hinges on the performance of the MEADI SLS rocket, also known as the Mega Moon rocket. 1 month ago in mid-June, NASA rolled the rocket onto the launch pad for a wet dress rehearsal meant to simulate an actual launch up to the final 9 seconds before liftoff. However, the launch was aborted with 29 seconds left on the countdown clock due to a hydrogen leak within the rocket. One thing that I'll be most interested in learning about in all this stuff would be how the robots are going to be deployed and how the robots will work out in these missions and how the robots, what the robots will be doing on the moon before the people get there. Will they be building bases there? Will they will they be building a base there for the astronauts to land on? So that is one of the things that really intrigues me, how the robots will be doing. The success of the mission hinges on the performance. Oh, I've read that already. Despite this early end to the research rehearsal, NASA said that the SLS met about 90% of its pre-launch objectives, with only a few kinks left to iron out. Since then, engineers have replaced the faulty seals that allowed the hydrogen leak, NASA said. So I'm wondering, how can you get faulty seals like that? And because everything is checked and rechecked and rechecked, and then all of a sudden there's a hydrogen leak. Standing 322 feet or 98 meters tall when capped with the Orion crew capsule, the SLS is taller than the Statue of Liberty and weighs a massive 5.75 million pounds or 2.6 million kilograms, according to NASA. While the SLS is slightly shorter than NASA's Saturn V rocket, used during the Apollo missions of the 1960s and 70s, it is considerably stronger. Wow. Capable of delivering about 8.8 million pounds or 4 million kilograms of thrust, or 15% more than the Saturn V's 7.5 million pounds or 3.4 million kilograms. According to NASA, the SLS is the most powerful rocket ever built. So let's see, we have a video here. Let's see if I can play it. I will try to play this video, which is probably about the rocket, and let's see if it cooperates with me.
On January 17th, NASA plans to ignite the most powerful rocket it's ever built, the core liquid-fueled rocket of the Space Launch System. The Space Launch System has been in development for years. It's the rocket ship that NASA plans to use to send people to the moon in the next decade, if everything goes according to plan. The final version will have a central rocket and two solid rocket boosters strapped to the sides, but it's that central rocket that's going through testing right now. NASA is coming to the end of what it calls its Green Run program, a series of 8 tests to make sure that the rocket is ready for an eventual true test launch. The 8 tests started with just subjecting the rocket to extreme forces, seeing whether it could withstand the stresses of a launch without any fuel inside. And then they've done other tests along the way, building up to, in December, loading the rocket full of 700,000 gallons of supercooled liquid fuel, and then taking that fuel back out again. Everything's gone right so far, and now NASA is ready to light the rocket up. It won't go anywhere, but it will emit a powerful blast of energy, simulating a launch at NASA's Stennis Space Center near Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. The eventual space launch system won't be quite as tall as the Saturn V rockets that carried the Apollo program into space in the 1960s and 70s for the original moon missions, but it will be more powerful, emitting about 15% more thrust during launch than the Saturn V rockets did. It also can carry way more useful stuff into space, certainly than a space shuttle, and significantly more than the Saturn V rockets as well. However, there have been delays before with the space launch system, and it remains to be seen whether things will continue to go according to plan with no problems. There are no promises in the world of rockets.
So I guess I can leave you with that quote for the last word. There is no promises in the world of rockets. Isn't that a cool quote? Hang on. Okay, so thank you for listening to the show today. Of course, I thought anything about astronomy is interesting. So have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. This is Marco. You have been listening to Astro Talk on CIT.
You're listening to
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Ice cream man, can I have this? I want this over here, and a toast on by my father, and give me this ice over here, and vanilla cone. Thank you, ice cream man. Thank you, ice cream man.
Your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part 4 of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Men in the Morning.